You are listening to the Photo Bomb podcast with the world's greatest photographers, Boo Ray and Gary.
Welcome to the Photobomb podcast. My name is Boo Ray Perry, and joining me as always is Gary Hughes.
Well, hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good.
I think that I discovered about you today that you do the same thing I do on Mondays in your photography business, which is catch up on all the paperwork.
Yeah, I used to do it on Tuesdays, and now I do it on Mondays. And I think I should move it back to Tuesdays because it just really brings down. Like, Monday's not bad enough as it is. You know, you got to go in.
I got to do all the QuickBooks.
You got to pay your sales tax, and you got to pay your FICA, and you got to click all. You know, and you know, it's like you just wake up Monday, and you're like, oh, you know.
Yeah, that's. You should do something fun on Mondays. Mondays right. Should start with something momentous, with something to really set the tone for the week. What would that be? What would you think?
I don't know.
Would be the thing
something
you should
fun.
Do with a Monday?
It's work related. I don't know. There is, you know, I think maybe I'll start like, maybe I'll make Mondays like make a video day. And then Tuesday I'll go back to being. But you know, here's the thing. The reason I moved all the books and stuff to Monday was so that I could get it out of the way. So it wasn't hanging over my head.
You got to eat the frogs.
But if you're going to have it hanging over your head, better to be working on Monday with it hanging over your head Tuesday than to be off on Sunday with it hanging over your head Monday.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, I start off my Monday pretty good. Monday's the day I take my 5-year-old to preschool.
Okay.
And so I always start off the day with a ride in the car where we listen to children's stories podcasts. We listen to music, the hot song in my house right now. And God bless her, Carly Rae Jepsen is a genius at the earworm song. I'm sure that you've heard a Carly Rae Jepsen song.
Maybe I've heard one and don't know it.
It's funny that you should say maybe, because her number one smash hit was Call Me Maybe.
Oh, of course I know Call Me Maybe, yeah.
Right.
Oh, that girl had more songs?
Yo, she's been around a while, apparently, and she's got a pretty deep catalog of very catchy songs. And the one that's in my car, basically on repeat, is Carly Rae Jepsen. And by the way, if there was a Jeopardy category for things I'm an expert on, if we had to make a category, and they said, make any category you want so that you're the best in the category, I would pick Carly Rae Jepsen lyrics. That would be the Jeopardy category. So the song is called I Really Like You. Okay. And I'm going to sing a bit of it for you now.
All right.
Because it is, I would like you to get into the poetry of Carly Rae Jepsen. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm going to read it in the form of poetry.
Okay.
I really, 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 really like you. That's the hook. That's the hook of the song.
I feel like it was the eighth really that really brought it home for me.
It really did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And the first seven reallys, I was like, I was okay. And then the eighth really just really like almost a little choked up.
It really nearly messed up the song for me, but it's just the right amount of reallys. It's just not too few reallys, not too many. Just when you're about to get sick of the reallys, she drops in like you.
Right.
I really, 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 really like you. And that's the song. And I'm telling you, it's so infectious. And here's a part that you'll like. This is how I'm going to tie it to Boo Ray's generation. Are you ready? So my girls like to watch music videos.
Right.
And so if you open up Apple Music on the Apple TV, it also shows videos related to songs that you're looking at. And so there's a music video for this. The entire song is Tom Hanks lip syncing the song while he's walking down the street. That's the whole music video.
That's great.
Isn't that great?
That's
it's
great.
Genius.
Yeah.
It's absolutely
genius.
How do you
get Tom Hanks to do that?
Clearly, Tom Hanks is a fan. You know, like, it's not like you're going to be, hey, Tom Hanks, I'm going to give you your commensurate $22 million to do this for me. It's literally like, he's probably one of his kids or grandkids, if he's got any. Somebody likes this song. I don't know. He might love the song too. Who knows? But like, it's a very catchy.
Right.
I encourage you. I know that you don't love pop junk food as much as I do. I love pop music junk food. And this is probably the ultimate example in the 21st century of pop music junk food, and it is impossible to get it out of your head for a while once you've heard it. It is infectious.
Okay.
Song. And so it's on repeat. So we're driving to school, and we have to pick up my neighbor's kid, who often babysits. She's a teenager. And so I'm driving her to school as well. So I, have you ever tried to talk to a teenager before?
I have two of them. Yeah.
Like there's a, she's 14 and there's this age, I think between the age of like zero and the age of like 12, they say 90% of the words they're going to say in their life. And all of a sudden they hit 13 and it's literally monosyllabic communication only. It's like some biological imperative because, you know, I'm like, so, hey, how's school going? Good. All right, cool. Any teachers you're digging or subjects going on? Play any sports? No, not really.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And you know, like just like trying to
Well, make the thing is at that point is that talking to you is beneath them because that's the age where they begin to believe that they know everything. And that will last until about 55.
Oh, good. So I'm not worth wasting breath on.
Right, because it's just like the old dude driving the car that I babysit with, you know.
The middle-aged neighbor who drives a Subaru Outback.
He's not going to understand the depth and breadth of the problems that I have every day going to school.
How could he possibly? It's not like he's done it before.
I mean, how many times have your parents said that to you when you were a kid when they try to, you know, when you're like, I can't wait to be out of school. I can't wait to be out there doing a job, et cetera, et cetera. And your parents are trying to say, trust me, this is the best time of your life right now. If you would just realize that your only thing you have to do is get up and go to school. I wish the only thing I had to do was get up and go to school.
My parents had a magnet on the fridge that said, hire a teenager while they still know everything.
Yeah. I mean, you think that, oh, I can't. I remember my big thing to my mom was always, yeah, but mom, you work all day, but you can just get up and go get a Coke anytime you want. Like, I thought that was the big caveat to having to worry about supporting your family and working and doing all the things, but you could get a Coke anytime you wanted. So all of that was easy because of that little perk. Whereas me, I'm in a living hell here at Washita Parish High School, Mom.
Yeah. Well, this is, there's a window. One of the things that kids often say is like, I could go to bed whenever I want. I could stay out as late as I want. There's literally like an 18-month window where that's true as an adult. And after that, it's literally you're still, not only then do you go to the point where you have to get up for a job, but by the time you might have enough financial success to maybe not have to get up at 7 in the morning, 6 in the morning, you either have kids, so you have to get up that early, or it's 9 o'clock and you're exhausted.
Right.
Like it's literally, it's not fun. It's not as much fun as being a kid. I admit that being made to clean my room and not being able to drink all the soda I wanted was a small bummer, but not as much of a bummer as like lower back pain. Right. not as much of a bummer as taxes. Those things are so much more of a bummer. So yeah, you know, it's anyway. So I'm taking my 5-year-old to school, and this always picks me up in the morning because my 5-year-old, she's a beast, man. She's a self-possessed, powerful young lady. And she is very playful and funny, and she's ask forgiveness instead of permission kid, and she's just hysterical. And so do you have anything that you say to your kids or when they were little you would say to them every day when you dropped them off, like a mantra or anything like that?
No, I wish I had. I thought a good one, if I in retrospect, I would have liked to have said, be a leader, like every day. Be a leader.
Be a leader.
Be kind or something. But instead, I would just get out of the car.
Yeah, salted. Come on. There's a bottle of bourbon with daddy.
Have a good day. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't have any great like stuff that my kids will take with them forever.
Well, I have one that I say that's only partially funny, and I say it.
Let me guess.
Most every day.
Is it? I really, 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 really like you.
And I want you. Do you want me? Do you want me too?
Yeah, that would be great.
No, I say. Destroy your enemies. Bring honor to the family name.
Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of the women.
The lamentations of the women, yes.
That's from Conan, by the way, for those of you.
Yeah. My kids always roll their eyes when I say this. They're like, yeah. But today, I drop my 5-year-old off. I give her a big hug. I said, love you, honey. And then I hold her back for me a little bit. And she looks at me and I said, destroy your enemies. And she goes, and bring honor to the family name. And she smiles really big.
That's a great moment.
And then she runs off to class.
You're like, yeah. You feel great, right? You feel really good?
Get him.
Yeah.
Get him.
Yeah, I feel really good. If my kid did that, I'd be, oh, that's awesome.
Destroy your enemies and bring honor to the family name. Like, get it. see them driven before you, hear the lamentations of the women. Yeah, it was a good moment. So that was my Monday. But the rest of the day, I've been on Zoom calls. This is an unusual day for me. Spent most of the day today on the Zoom. I was going to say on the phone. That is, why is that a 20th century sentence all of a sudden? I spent most of the day on the Zoom. I am a boomer officially because I call it the Zoom. Spent most of my day on the Facebook, on Zoom rather, with people working on various projects I got going on. And it occurred to me that I spend very little of my life on Zoom compared to some of my friends who live and work in the corporate world.
Sure.
Because like there's a catch 22 of people who, you know, because of the pandemic, remote work is a lot more common, right? And I have a lot of clients and a lot of friends and family who now work remotely, my brother, my sister-in-law, and they never have to go into the office, which seems cool until you realize the double-edged sword of that is that you have to basically be in Zoom calls all the time. And that's awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awful. Microsoft Teams, Zoom, whatever you're doing. And I just feel really, really good that I get to notice how crappy a Zoom is than having to live in it all day long every day.
Yeah. I don't know. It's bad, but is it as bad as sitting in meetings every day?
I think it's the same thing, except maybe somehow worse because you're so close to your fridge and your comfy chair and all the things that you love and you can't do any of it.
Right.
Like at least at work, you know, nothing cool is going to happen there. Right. You're just going to be in a room. And I wonder, are Zoom meetings as unproductive as regular meetings?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so even more so because people are less inclined to interrupt or talk over anyone. So it's like everyone's waiting for their turn to speak. You know, I've been in many, many group settings on Zoom calls, you know, committees and stuff like that. And it's just excruciatingly slow to get anything done. Everybody's got to come in and say their little thing. And, you know, I talk the least when I do Zoom calls.
Now, for those of our listeners who are stuck in that Zoom life, that Microsoft Teams meeting life, I thought we could play a fun game. We could say, are you ready? I know how much you love playing fun games.
All right.
So let's play a fun game. The top five things about Zoom calls, about being on Zoom meetings.
Okay.
Okay. You want me to go first?
Well, I think we're both. Number one is obvious.
No pants.
No pants is number one.
No pants. Yeah, obviously. Yep.
Okay.
How about you can turn your camera off and just start openly smoking while the meeting's going on?
Okay, I like that. But I mean, can you? Aren't they going to be like, why is your camera off? Because they might think you're openly doing something else with your lack of pants.
Yeah, that's also fair. Yeah, right. That's also fair. All right, so we got pants, openly smoking. What else you got?
Vodka disguises coffee.
Ooh, that's actually really good. They can't smell liquor on you on a Zoom call.
That's right. That's right.
You can be hungover and blame how bad you look on bad lighting.
Right. Cat in your lap is a good one. You can have, you know, you can have a
cat in your lap. Yeah. Okay. That's good. That's one. We need one more. Cat in your lap, drink, openly smoking, and no pants.
Oh, complete lack of hygiene.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to take a bath.
No.
That's great.
Yeah. Zoom calls are great.
So, yeah. In their own way, Zoom calls are fantastic. So, hey, Bombardiers, if you have any other great things about your Zoom life, go ahead and send a message to us in the Bombardiers Lounge or to questions@photobombpodcast.com. We want to know how you're surviving that Zoom life out there. So what else is going on?
I was in the studio this week, and I have a light stand that is one of those big steel rolling caster wheel, you know, really big ones like that you would use to
like,
hold up.
Do they have like the black feet that fold up and down? Like they clunk and they're really like heavy, or is it like the big legs that are at like the 45 degree angle with the 45 degree support?
45 degree. They're like a regular light stand, but much bigger, thick metal, you know, with big rolling caster wheels on them. They're designed to be able to hold like a camera, like, I don't mean like a video camera, like a full, like a big thing. What happened was I ordered it years ago because I needed a bigger light stand to hold my.
Oh, I've seen this one in videos of yours and stuff.
Right,
yeah,
the
I've
giant
seen
umbrella.
This one before.
And it was a little bit, I ordered one that was a little bit bigger than I needed, but it was so big and such a pain to get out of the box that I didn't want to ship it back. So I just kept it. But it always bothered me because if you try to make it smaller, right, if you just try and move the legs up so the wheels come in more, then the wheels are kind of off at an angle and it doesn't roll well.
Right. Yep.
So I'm like,
they
great.
Get Charlie Chaplin. Great. Feet. Yeah, it's no good.
Screwed. Great. So then I was just sitting there working in the studio and I looked over at it and I looked at where the wheel's attached to the body and I noticed that it's a slot. It's not like a hole. It's like a running groove slot where the wheel's attached to the body. And that slot is at an angle. It comes down the leg and then out a little bit. And so the leg's fully extended and it's straight and the wheel's right there. And I'm like, wait a minute. So I go over and I loosen the thing and I move the leg, the things up. And for those of you who can't figure out what I'm doing, imagine any light stand if you just try to make the footprint smaller. That's what I'm doing, right? So I'm moving it up. And then I notice that the slot goes, the wheels get in a bad position, but now the slot that was curved is now flat. And I'm like, oh.
The whole time.
It's designed so that you can move the wheels to this other portion here, and you can actually bring it in and make it smaller footprint. So this is like the highlight of my week.
Upside down ketchup bottle effect.
Yes, exactly. This is fantastic. So now I got to take these giant wheels off. So I go and I grab tools. I come back upstairs. That's not right. I go grab another tool. I come back up. I finally just go get my whole box of wrenches and I bring them up to find the right one. And I finally take the wheel off and I loosen it and I move it and I lock it down. Good. This is fantastic. We're off to the races. I roll it over to get to the next wheel. And that's when I notice on the leg, taped to the leg, is the wrench that came with the stand specifically so you could move the wheels that I taped to the leg so that I would be able to find it if I ever needed it. And that's what it is to be old, Gary.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you didn't read any kind of instruction manual on
this. It's possible I did not read the instruction manuals at all.
I mean, let's just assume that
you pulled it out and I was like, a wrench. I don't know what this is for because I didn't use it. So let me just tape it to the leg in case I need it. And then like 5 years later, I'm like, oh, that wrench is for fixing the wheels and solving this problem you've been dealing with for 5 years.
All right. So stupid things that you should have known. I think I'm the winner. So early on in my photography, I was 2 years or so into my photography business. And we went out shooting clay pigeons with some friends who were photographers. And they've been in it a bit longer. And they're very, very talented. And they brought it was a Canon 1DX or one. It's one of the one series Canons. Because that's what they shot with. And they brought that camera out so we could all take pictures of each other shooting these clay pigeons. And so my friend takes pictures of me. I mean, I didn't hit any because, not my thing. And then she goes up to shoot and I go grab the camera to take a picture of her. Then I hold it up to my eye. I look in the viewfinder and the autofocus point is all the way to the left. And I went, oh my God, you can move the autofocus point. That's 2 years as a 2 years as a freshman. And here was the funny part. So I was shooting a lot of actors' headshots at that point. And that usually the style of that is very often a shallow depth of field. So I was shooting with like a 50mm and an 85mm, 1.8 and 1.4. And I would use the center focus point, focus on their eye, and then recompose. And at that shallow of a depth of field, I'm focusing on it and then immediately changing the plane of focus and bringing the field. And I was having a really hard time. When I pulled up my files, I would look at them for focus and be like, why are the eyes always out of focus? I'm focusing on the eyes. And then that all exploded in my brain the minute I picked up my friend's camera. I was like, oh my God, I'm the biggest idiot in the world. This is why you need to like read instruction manuals. But
I remember when personal computers were first coming out, a friend of mine had a Mac and another friend of his was on the computer and they were trying to write something and he had written like a paragraph and my friend said, oh, no, that's not going to work. You have to rewrite that. And he started backspacing, tick, 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 like the whole paragraph, tick, 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 tick. And both of us were like, no, you can just select the whole thing and delete it. What? You can just select the whole thing. How long have you been backspacing letter by letter for every single thing you ever need to get rid of?
And at that point, the tick, tick, tick is comforting. Like,
yeah. Tick, 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 I guess tick, tick.
So. So I did a fun thing this weekend.
Okay.
Did you know that it's the 40th anniversary of Return of the Jedi?
I did not know. 40 years. Wow.
40th anniversary. Yeah.
I saw it twice in the theater back to back. I went and saw it, came out. My buddy was in line to see it. I got back in line with him and saw it again.
So So and totally worth it. Did you realize that at that distance, since Return of the Jedi came out in 1943, that it is about equidistant from Pearl Harbor as it is from today?
It's just as long from today, yes, to Return of the Jedi as it is from Return of the Jedi,
to Pearl Harbor.
Oh, that's, yes, great. That's a fantastic fact. I love that.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, right? So they were they're replaying it in theaters all the way up to May the 4th. You know, May the 4th be with you. And so a bunch of us friends went out. We all got babysitters. We took none of our children. And we went out and I watched Return of the Jedi on the big screen. Gosh, for the first time. And the last time it was out was 1997 or something, when they did the re-releases of the special editions. It was the first time I'd seen it on a big screen in like 20 years. And you want to know what I noticed?
Mm.
Harrison Ford is incredibly funny. He carries the comedic scenes in that movie so, so well. Like all of the scenes where like he just uses his face to make dumb faces in weird moments. And right, in what is otherwise a kind of a serious space opera type movie, he just, without hamming it up, without ruining a scene, just gives an incredible amount of comic relief in a lot of these scenes. I was like, that was the one thing that I've always really missed in Star Wars, is I never really paid attention. I'm always like, ooh, lightsabers and Jedis and dark versus light and good guys and bad guys. I'm like, man, the comedy is really, really good. And the best scene, if you want to watch Harrison Ford's facial expressions chewing up scenery but doing a great job, is in, there's a scene when they get captured by the Ewoks. Remember this? They get caught up in the big, mm-hmm, net, and, mm-hmm, then they get cut down out of the net, and they're all looking around at the Ewoks, and all of a sudden C-3PO sits up, and all the Ewoks go, wah, and they start to worship C-3PO as a god.
Right.
And like that, the 30 seconds of that scene is the funniest thing in Star Wars, is Han Solo reacting to C-3PO finding out that the Ewoks think that he's a god. It's fantastic. Like Mark Hamill is even cognizant of the character, and he thinks it's funny, and he's covering his mouth and cracking up the background as he sees how pissed Han Solo is getting at the situation. There's just a really great moment in that when they're, you know, abducted by a bunch of tiny teddy bears.
You're right. He is very funny. And when you think about it, everyone is, except for Luke and Leia. They're pretty much serious.
No, they're not
the whole,
funny at all.
Serious through the whole run. But everybody else, especially 3PO and R2-D2, they are literally the comic relief of the film.
Well, they're supposed to be, but Han Solo's the funniest.
But you're right. Like, he really is funny. Just the expressions, and he's a goofball, you know. But
So I discovered this, the magic of Lucasfilm movies. And I mean like Indiana Jones, Willow, Star Wars. I call it the RFQ. Everything that makes those movies good is RFQ. Running, fighting, quipping. If you're running and fighting at the same time and throwing funny quips out while you're running and fighting, that's the best. That's peak Lucasfilm. Every Lucasfilm movie is at its best. Run, fight, and quip. The king of the run, fight, quip, Val Kilmer is Mad Mardigan in Willow. Indiana Jones, you know, Han Solo. Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. Run, fight, quip. That's all I want. I want an entire movie of the run, fight, quip.
And then when you look at the Marvel movies, it's run, fight, and then when you're not run, fight, quip. Marvel, yes, movies are like it's a comedy, and then there's a fight, and it's a comedy, and then there's a fight.
You know, I mean, there's a little bit of run, fight, quip, but not nearly the amount.
No, in the actual, and except for Spider-Man. Spider-Man, of course, is the king of the fight, quip.
He should be.
Yeah. I mean, that's just always been his whole thing. I mean, when I was young, a friend of mine said he loves Spider-Man. And I said, why do you love Spider-Man so much? She said, because even when he's getting his ass kicked, he's always mouthing off. And I was like, Okay, I can respect that. Sure. That's true. That's his
character.
I think
that would be you if you had superpowers. I think you would absolutely be talking trash. Yeah,
no.
You'd be
mostly
saying,
I would
funny,
just say, crush your enemies and make your family proud.
Yeah.
Or advance your
destroy
families.
Your enemies and bring honor to the family name. Whatever. It was a good callback.
I know. So how many years did it take for your kids to remember? You can't expect me to come up with it right away.
That's right. Yeah. It took Josie the entire school year to get it right.
I have a question for you.
All right. Go for it.
Okay. So I go up to the grocery store. There's a family in the parking lot. Mother, father, two children. They got a speaker and it's playing some sort of classical music. The father has a violin plugged in. He's playing the violin along with the music. Beautiful. Son is there. He also has a violin. He's playing. He's not plugged in, but he's playing.
Okay.
People are, you know, giving him some money. Okay. Right? We got that?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
Feel okay about that?
The son's not plugged in.
He's not plugged in, but the father is, and they're playing the music, right? Okay, fine.
But the son is actually playing, but he's not plugged in.
Right.
Okay.
Wearing his school clothes. But then next to them, a big sign. And the sign says something to the effect of, need help.
I really, really, really like
you. It says something to the effect of, need help, can't support the family, please help, God bless.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that, Gary?
All right, so let me just reset the scene.
Yeah.
Kids in school clothes, like a school uniform?
Yeah, like a school uniform.
Okay, all right. And with his dad, and they're playing violin.
And mom, mom and dad.
Okay, so three of them. It's a trio.
Four.
A trio. Got it.
Two kids and two parents.
Oh, so it's a quartet.
It's a quartet, but only two of them are playing. Two on the violin.
Okay, two on the violin. First question, was it any good?
I mean, yeah, the dad could play the violin.
Like, proficiently play the violin.
Yeah, could play the violin. He was playing along with the classical music that was playing over the speaker that they had brought that was on a stand.
Indoors, outdoors?
Outdoors.
Where outdoors?
Right when you come in from the street, there's like you drive into the parking lot, and then you get to a stop sign right there at the center, and then you turn right or left, you know, to go to whichever, and park in front of whichever store you're going to come in. And they were right there under a tree, right there at that corner.
So I have questions.
Okay.
Are you asking me how I feel about people panhandling with their kids?
No.
Or are you asking me how I feel about violin music?
It's the whole thing, because we got the panhandling, and then now at this particular grocery store near my house, we more often are seeing someone up there with a sign saying that they need to support their kids or whatever, and they'll have their kid with them.
Right, yeah, I see quite a bit. I'm generally sort of opposed to including your children.
Right, this was a new step up where they had brought a speaker and violins to play music while asking for money with a sign that said, you know, please help us, we need money.
What quality was the sign?
It was, you know, written like with a big marker on a big piece of cardboard.
Like, as long as it wasn't printed by Fast Signs.
No,
had like
it wasn't.
Okay.
And so I just thought about it. And of course, you know, I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And do I have a problem with this? And what would be my specific problem with it? And so then I thought, well, I'll throw this out to Gary and see if he has any. Because I can tell you my problem, maybe I shouldn't say problem. But my thing was just like if you want to come and entertain to get money, that's great. And if you want to beg for money because you need it, that's another thing. But then when you mix the two, I just felt like it makes it weird for me, because like giving you money because you're entertaining is one thing, giving you money because you're begging for it is another thing, and now you've mixed the two.
All right, so what you're saying is you're not into hobotainment.
I'm not into hobotainment. I don't think
no,
so.
No.
Okay, no. Okay, I mean, if it's hobotainment, leave the hobo out. Just entertain. Just entertain and dance in the street and ask for money. But when you dance in the street and you're whatever and you ask for money and you also have a sign that says, please God help me, I'm begging for money.
It was the sign that you don't like.
Yeah, that was exactly what I didn't like. If they had just been up there playing instruments and with a guitar case out, I love that. What do they call it? A busker. I love a busker.
Busking, yeah.
I love a busker. Nothing wrong with a busker.
What if the sign had said, much like a car wash or something, like raising money for music school? Or raising money for music lessons for my kids or something.
Oh, now we get into a whole other. Now we get into a whole other area, you know, because you know that I have an issue with the people who, you know, my daughter's going through that now. She's got to go to London to march in the parade, and the school is like, send out emails to everybody you know and ask them to donate money.
Yeah,
to
you we went into that.
I'm like, that's my job. You know, and there's two different areas there. If you can support your kids and everything, that's fine. Now, if you're homeless and you're trying to raise money so your kids can take music lessons, I'm there for you.
Well, I also think there are priorities there. If you're homeless and you're raising money for music lessons, you should probably be raising money for a home. But
but I'm just saying, I'm there for you. I can see if you're trying to raise money to help your kids, to provide something for your kids that you couldn't provide otherwise, like for instance, music lessons. But if what you're trying to provide for your kids is something that's above and beyond, like, you know, when you see like the parents that are raising money for their kids, and I'm going to probably tick off a listener, but if you're out begging for money for your kids so that they can pay for their traveling baseball team, it's like, that's not Little League.
So if the sign wasn't there,
you have to try out for these teams. That's like a semi-pro kind of team situation. And if your kid, you're going to put your kid into that, then that's your responsibility, not mine.
So what you want to do is to clarify intent.
I guess so. It's just, it was a weird mixture of the two between entertaining for money, but also begging for money. And I didn't like that. It was a weird pressure. I know how to handle either one of those two on their own, but when you put them together, now it's like, I'm giving you this money, but I want you to know I'm giving it to you because you're playing music, not because you're begging. Or I'm giving this money to you because you're begging, not because you're playing music. You know what I'm saying? It's like I want to know exactly what's going on. What's this transaction about? There's too many questions in the transaction.
See, I find it generally that I would just think that if they're sitting there playing music under a tree, to me it doesn't really matter how they got there or why they're there or what they're doing for it. It's like clearly wherever they're at in their life is not great if that's what they're doing with
right.
their day.
Right. Could be, you know, yeah.
Or they'll just hop over and get into the BMW and drive home to their house in the fancy part of town. I have no idea. But maybe it's a performance art. I have no idea. But I don't think it would bother me like it bothered you. I don't have strict rules about giving money to people on the street because I just don't do it in general.
Right. I don't usually do it in general either, but I will give money on the street to somebody who's performing. You know, I'm a big believer in it. Dudes just do something to earn it. And they were.
Like they were playing music. Tell a joke.
Yeah, they were playing music to earn it.
Sing a
okay,
song.
That's great. But then you're also begging for it with a big sign.
Is it? I think you're splitting hairs. I think you're getting too worked up about nothing.
I'm not worked up at all about it. I was confused about it because I'd never seen it. So I was just like, I honestly did not know how I felt about it. I know how I feel about it if you're there with a sign, and I know how you feel about it if you're there playing music, but I don't know how I feel about it if you're playing music with a sign.
I don't think it even crossed my mind. Yeah. So let me ask you this. What could they write on the sign that would make it all make sense to you so it wouldn't confuse you?
Oh, just like, you know, the Wilson Family's Trio, or just the name of the group, you know, or whatever, and we're just here and we're playing music and we'd love it if you donated or something, but
and the mom and the sister were just sitting there.
Yeah, they were sitting there digging into the Chinese food that they had bought from the Chinese place.
Ah, see, tambourine or something, missed opportunity. People love a family band, don't they?
Also, the Chinese place next to a grocery store where they could have bought that food for a quarter of the price. See, there I go. Now I've become that guy. Then you become the guy where you're like, now I'm like, listen, if you're begging for money, why are you buying the fast food when you could, there's a grocery store right there. You could have gone.
Because then they'd have to have a place to take it home and cook it, I reckon. That's probably
not necessarily.
That's probably what I would say.
There's stuff. There's
cold
cuts.
Yeah, they'll just go to one of those communal stoves that they got all throughout the community.
There's cold cuts and stuff like that. You know, you could get, I'm just, again, see, then you go down that road and then you're like, that people are going to, you know, don't.
You sound very privileged right now.
I do, right? That does sound that way. I know. Yeah. And that's why I don't like it, because there's a, if you give people money, then you start to take a little bit of an ownership of what they do with that money, and you don't want to do that.
No, it's not your job. You're not the money police.
It's not your job. Just decide if you want to give them the money. And I don't take that ownership if you're just playing music for money. I'm just like, here you go. Go buy yourself a drink. I don't care.
Okay, so.
But I guess it's because, here, but the reason I take ownership of it is because I feel bad for the kids.
I guess that's all relative, because they may not know much else. You know, they may not know anything. I've seen worse.
But they will know. There's a sign right there. You know, so I feel bad for the kids that this is their memory, is of them going with their family to play music and beg for money. And I wish they could just get rid of the sign and their memory would be, my family used to go play music, you know, and people would give us a few dollars. You know, if it was me, that's what I would try to do. Maybe they did. That's what I would try to do to hide it from my kids. You know, because I'd be embarrassed.
I think what you should do is go right back to that family and drop a sawbuck in the bucket and absolve yourself of this ridiculousness. That's what I think you should do.
I'm just saying, it was an interesting dynamic, because I'd never seen it before where it was a musician also begging.
How often do you get to say sawbuck anyway? That's just, I love throwing
that's
that
true.
In conversation.
Sawbuck's good.
This is good. And why is there always a Chinese restaurant in the same plaza as a grocery store? It's like when a developer is like, building a grocery store in a neighborhood, like, well, we got 8 spots for, you know, stores adjacent here to the Publix, like, 7, definitely got a Chinese place on lock already. How do you always do that? I'm telling you, I don't know what the deal is, but you're going to go grocery shopping and then grab some takeout Chinese on the way home. That doesn't seem to jive to me. That makes less sense than begging and performing at the same time.
What gets me is that a couple of times over the few years here, there have been other like Chinese or sushi places that have tried to go in there and we're like, what are you doing? You're not going to beat China Taste. You're not going to beat the place that's got, you know, that the people working behind the counter, their kids are doing their coloring book in the corner because the whole family works there and it's cheap and it's fast and it's hot and everything's ready in 10 minutes. I don't care what you order. You could call them up and say, I need a whole cow, 10 minutes. And everything's ready in 10 minutes. You're not going to beat
China Walk, Taste of China.
Yeah,
Taste China of Star, China. Yeah. China Jade.
China Moon. Yeah, China Moon. I mean, that is an institution. And you're
China,
not
China,
mess
China.
With it.
Yeah. Don't forget China, China, China.
You're not gonna mess with it.
Mm-hmm. No, man. The grocery store adjacent Chinese food place is an American institution, and I stand by that. Every word of that statement.
All right, it is that time. It is time for photography news.
Photography news.
All right, in photography news this week, I just real quickly wanted to talk about the photographers who lost all the gear when the launching pad for the SpaceX rocket blew up. Did you see this?
I saw the story. I didn't click on it.
Yeah, well, when they were going to do the rocket, they were asking, is it Elon? What's his name?
Elon.
They were asking Elon how he felt about the rocket was going to go, was the rocket going to blow up. He said, I'm honestly more worried about the launch pad. And he was right to be worried because the launch pad started to disintegrate under the force of the rocket.
The world's largest rocket.
Yeah, and one photographer lost $40,000 worth of gear. GoPros, Nikons, you name it. Anything that was near that rocket to try and, you know, record what was happening got hit by chunks of concrete flying at literally rocket speed. So there's
sounds
tons
like
of posts
something
about it.
Something that, you know, you should have expected might happen.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, some of it was like, if you look at they have footage and the cameras are pretty far away.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, right. Like, do you know the amount of thrust it takes to put a rocket that size into the sky? I don't, but I'm guessing it's a lot.
What are the odds that you get hit by? I mean, that must have been a lot of debris. That must have been like shotgun pattern debris.
It was actually one piece of debris that bounced off of every piece of this guy's equipment. It was an amazing statistical anomaly. It was unbelievable. It's literally right. Just one rock that hit everything.
One just damn
pew,
rock.
Pew, 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 pew. Yeah.
What are the odds?
It was like Captain America's shield. That's a statistical oddity. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, it's good stuff. Well, you know, it does. I'm hoping against hope that all that gear was insured because, yeah. And maybe they will put it further back next time or just expect SpaceX to replace it. So let's talk about our good friends at Leica.
Hail Leica.
Hail Leica. So Leica, and this was posted into the Bombardier's lounge by someone in there. Ah, there we go. The good friend Richard Green, listener. Thank you, Richard Green. Leica has a new camera coming out. Nay, strike that, a new watch coming out. Leica has announced the new Leica Watch ZM1 and ZM2 designs that it says were inspired by the M11 monochrome, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, I think, on the show that was launched earlier this month. So essentially, it's a watch or two, but I gotta say, God, they're really beautiful watches, and I would absolutely love to have one.
Sure. Listen, anytime you give me black on black is always beautiful.
Is it? Is that what?
Yeah,
that what
just
you're
black
into?
On black. And like I like a black suit with a black shirt and a black tie. Again, this watch is everything in this watch is black except for the numbers. Yeah, great. Beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It is an absolutely stunning piece of timewear, and for the right person. Now, let me ask you this: how much would you pay for a watch like this?
How much would I pay?
Yeah.
That's a Leica watch.
Because not only have they made a camera that only takes monochrome photos, right, but now they've made two watches based on the camera.
Maybe top dollar for me, maybe $1,000.
Okay.
Because if I'm paying $5,000-$6,000, it's Rolex or it's Omega.
All right. Okay. So just buckle up, Buttercup.
Oh Lord.
There are two watches in this line. There is the ZM1. Which will retail for $12,730, and the ZM2, which will retail at $17,000.
Oh, man.
So both of these watches more expensive than the camera they're based
wow.
on.
Wow. Wow. I mean, is like a watch brand. I don't know modern watch brands. Is it now, is it at that level now? Is it at the Rolex, Patek Philippe, you know, Omega level where people collect them and they hold their value or increase? Do they do that?
It is interesting because as a camera brand, Leica is really the Rolex of cameras as far as business model is concerned, whereas all the special editions, collaborations, the forced scarcity, you know, the boutiqueness of it, the way that they go up in value over time very often as opposed to down in value. So if you were to equate two brands, it really seems like a natural fit for Leica making small motorized precision compartments in ground glass. It seems like a natural progression, actually, to move into the watch business. So I would imagine as long as they are, and I'm looking at the article to see if there's like a watch company that they're using.
Oh, here's while you're looking. Also, look to see when they started it, because we're talking about like moving into the watch company and maybe they've been doing this since 1943.
No, I don't think so.
And we just don't know.
Let's see. Leica's watch collection currently consists of two models, the ZM1 and the ZM2, which stands for Zeitmesser, the German descriptive word for an instrument that measures and displays time, which both employ a mechanical hand-wound movement that was developed in-house.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
These watches were originally launched in February of 22 in limited numbers as the L1 and L2, but were at some point after renamed. And so here we go, the Z1 and Z... If I was a dentist and had just... a lot of money sitting around and didn't have four kids sucking my soul and my bank account dry, I would 100% be totally fine with having one of these or both of these watches. I think they're gorgeous. And typically speaking, if Leica is to be relied upon to do what it always does, which is go up in value, although I don't think that their watch brand has the storied history of the camera brand, but maybe they're trying to, you know, get some of that shine off onto their watches, this might even be a good investment, to be fair. You know, it really could. Like, so, you know, they're beautiful. I'm sure they work great. And for the right person, this would be a lovely Father's Day gift.
They're having the Leica auction soon. And I was looking through some of the stuff that they're offering. And many of the cameras they're expected to go for a high price are black-on-black cameras, black versions of Leica cameras. So maybe that's just, it's having a moment now with Leica.
Yeah, the modern. Well, you know, I sent you a video earlier that someone sent to me, and I'm trying to remember who sent it to me, but it's one of the listeners of the show, maybe Dave Kalmbach, I'm not really sure, sent me the link to a YouTube video about the Leica M11 monochrome, which we talked about on the show, and why it actually might make better black and white images.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a crow for you and I. We made fun of it extensively in the last podcast, and now, as it turns out, the sensor on a monochrome camera should produce images that are better in low light because it has bigger photoreceptors, because the photoreceptors only have to capture monochrome, whereas on a regular sensor, the photoreceptors have to capture red, green, and blue. So there's three photoreceptors for every one, and so that one can be bigger. That's the, you know, the condensed version of why that works. But they say, yeah, that's why the ISO is so high on this camera, is that it can work better in low light. And they say that the grain, when you run into a grain problem, looks more film-like because of it.
Yeah, I watched the video and I'm like, I want one more now.
Yeah,
I really do. I gotta do.
Yeah, but then I watched the one that Jordan and what's his face? Who, Jordan and Chris.
Craig.
They did
Chris
one.
Nichols and Jordan Drake.
Yeah, well, you know, I thought the images were great. I thought they shot the video in monochrome, which was, I thought it was muddy. But the images were fantastic. And yeah, I'm with you. I want one too.
Yeah. If money were no object, I would certainly have one. And I'd join my local camera club just so I could strut around the senior center with it hanging around my neck. I would absolutely be doing that.
Yeah, I would love to have one as well.
So this is a story that you brought to my attention that I scanned the headline. I think we need to talk about. This is interesting and has to do with our robot overlords. May they be praised.
May they be praised.
EU law to force AI imagers to disclose copyrighted photos in their data set. What does that mean?
This is interesting because so many companies don't. And now there's a law in the EU that says, okay, you've got to reveal your data set. So if you're going to be producing images with AI, you have to reveal all of the images that you pulled the data from to teach your AI how to create images. Now, there are some companies that already do this. There's one called Stable Diffusion, And they use something called L-A-I-O-N, Laon.
Lion.
Is it Lion? Are you supposed to pronounce it that way?
It just sounds cooler than anything else.
Right.
So,
this is an open source data set that they pull from. So they're like, this is where we pull from. So if you go there, you can see all these images and you know that this is what we pull from. But other companies like Midjourney and DALL-E, they don't. They don't reveal where. They admitted that they scrub millions of images off the internet to create their data set. So right. Now telling them they have to show all the images they pull from, that's crazy. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Because I don't think they know all the images that they pull from. When the AI goes out and looks at these images, do they copy them into the AI? Are they sitting in a folder on a big monster computer somewhere? Because I didn't think they would. I thought they just went out and looked at images.
No idea.
Yeah, I have no idea either.
Unclear.
But it's quite a big deal, and I feel like it's also just a stepping stone. So, like, first step is we tell them that they have to reveal the data set, and then we start to use that in copyright infringement lawsuits.
Yeah, yeah, which is wild to think about. That Getty Images is already suing the crap out of Stable Diffusion and others, and this isn't over, because the more I think about this, the more irritated I get that these things wouldn't be able to do anything that they do without basically taking the copyrighted works of other artists and using them.
Right.
So yes, I think it's a cool tool. I think it's interesting. There's a lot of neat stuff, but everybody from writers to programmers to photographers and video makers, and video is certainly not safe from AI either. All of these jobs, these 21st century jobs that require like technology and digital stuff, all this stuff that we've been putting online to survive because you have to. And now that is being kind of turned on its head by these pieces of software that will take all the stuff that we've been sharing because we have to survive, and turning it around to make certain jobs irrelevant.
Yes, but
mm-hmm.
You can't make the picture without the model. You can't make the picture without the lights. You can't make the, I mean, everything that you do when you create something is dependent on someone else and someone else's work and someone something else. And you bring it all together to create something that's yours. So when AI, I couldn't create my work if it wasn't for all of the pictures that I've looked at and analyzed and learned from. How is that different?
Because it's not a person doing it.
Okay.
And because the people need jobs.
I'm with you on that. I'm absolutely with you on that. But I just don't, I don't see, in the grander sense, I don't see how it's much different than somebody who paints cottages with light in the woods and they go, oh, you paint like Thomas Kincaid. I'm going to sue you. Well, no, I'm allowed to look at Thomas Kincaid and paint like he does,
right.
Whoever. I can do that. Yeah. I mean, that's how art works. So,
well,
what's
derivative works, certain types of derivative works are protected, but they do go to court and get decided on by a judge.
Derivative work where they take your work and then change it. Yes. But
right. No, but derivative, but
they're not
also
taking
mean
your
like,
work. I mean, I feel like you would have to be able to be able to break it down by the pixel and show like there's a combination of pixels here that are exactly the same as a combination of pixels in my image, which means it didn't just look at my image and try to copy it. It literally copy-pasted a piece of my image into this image. Well, now you're taking my copy.
I think it's such a mess that this is going to be hashed out in the courts for a long time. I mean, there is a possibility. I feel like enough people are speaking out against this, or like, yeah, but we got to put some bumpers on this. That I'm interested. I'm very interested to see where the court cases go over the next 5 or 10 years, because this really has only become like it is in the last 12 months. Although this EU lawsuit was this EU laws was started to draft 2 years ago before most people were even aware that this kind of stuff existed.
Right.
And so I'm really, really fascinated to see where legally we end up, to where it's basically like, okay, yeah, you can use AI wherever and however you want, and it doesn't matter like who it hurts or what industries it destroys or what creativity it kills or what, it does, or it doesn't matter. If anything new is ever made, as long as it's easy. And I think that's tough. That's tough to swallow for a lot of us. And I'm not necessarily an alarmist, because I I'm going to figure out how to make a living for my family, and I'm going to pivot and do whatever I have to do in my business to make sure that I'm okay. And you've done it before. Heck, you turn your whole life in the opposite direction when things went bad, and that happens. That's what you have to do sometimes when there's a huge sea change in technology. But it's this will be one of the first times I've been in an industry that is really in the middle of this, you know? And it very well could be the second career I've had that has also been made irrelevant by technology. My first career, I was a projectionist. And now that, I'm threading, slicing films, putting together, running reel to reel stuff. And that doesn't exist anymore, which blows my mind. Like, it's all digital. So like, eventually, I think everybody lives long enough to see their industry radically changed or eliminated by some kind of automation or technology. And so,
well, I think right now, if you're a person who makes your living by taking pictures of inanimate objects,
oh yeah, you're done.
You're done. You're in deep trouble. Right?
Yeah, you're done.
But portrait photographers are not in trouble until AI gets to the point where you can just go in and say, hey, give me a portrait of my family, you know, lit by five lights and in the style of Tim Kelly. And it will produce that picture. And no one looking at it would be able to tell that it wasn't actually a picture of your family. That's when the real death knell starts to ring for photography. That's when we're in deep trouble.
I think anything related to an event is probably pretty safe. So whether it's weddings or event photography or photo booth stuff, like anything that's like tied to the sentimental nature of a thing that happened, I think is probably in pretty good shape for at least for the time being, until it's generally accepted that you're going to walk into somebody's house and all the pictures on the walls will have been made by AI. You know, that just gives me the shivers to think.
Except they won't be on the wall. They'll be part of the wall, because the wall will just be a giant screen that can be anything you want it to be.
Right. Like the Microsoft table.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be like that. I'm ready for that. I really am.
In the future.
I'm ready for that, where you can just have the whole wall just changes and becomes whatever you want it to be. You know, and also what I want to see is AI where like you can take a picture of a couple during the first dance, and then it takes that picture and creates a 360 degree, like the Matrix, when they would slow down the Matrix when they were shooting.
Bullet time.
Like a bullet time shot of, you know, around them. So it looks like you had a complete rig all the way around them, but it's actually all generated by AI. That's coming. Mark my words, that'll be something you start to see in wedding photography in like 5 years.
So do you want to hear in dumb photography inventions news?
Okay. I know what this is going to be too. I was going to talk about this too.
This camera gives you a receipt instead of your photos.
The Memgram camera. Yeah, the Memgram. I love this.
Okay, tell me what this is.
I think it's stupid, but I love it. I love that someone thought to do it, because I feel like it's kind of tongue in cheek. They can't possibly hope to actually make any real money off of it. I just think it's gimmicky. You know, it's just funny. So it's a camera. It's like a cardboard camera that you would buy, like a one-time use camera. And it doesn't give you a picture. It's got 36 exposures. That's it. And when you take a picture with it, it literally prints out a little receipt that tells you what the picture is of. So the way it works,
Jesus,
is you take the picture goes up to the cloud. They have software that looks at the picture and figures out what it is. Then it prints out a little receipt. You pull the receipt off the camera, and it says, you know, picture of a guy happy, taken on this day at this time at this place. And then like a month later, you actually get access to your pictures online.
Why?
Yeah, why exactly? But here's the thing. When you think about it, there's some parts of it that are kind of interesting. First of all, if you buy like a digital one-time use camera, it's not going to have a screen in it because it's too expensive to put that into a one-time use camera, right? So if you're getting a one-time use camera, it's not going to have a screen anyway. So you're not going to see the picture until you go to a website somewhere, right? It's going to send them up to the cloud, or something's going to connect to your phone or something. The receipt thing is kind of gimmicky. It's just kind of a gimmicky receipt. But the idea that you would have a one-time digital use camera where you would take a picture and then you wouldn't actually see it, because, you know, otherwise you'd have to spend $100 on 36 pictures. That makes sense. But the receipt part is like you're going to keep all these 36 receipts, you know, in your purse.
This is like a very strange Wes Anderson kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's so bizarre. It's like a very strange, almost sci-fi dystopian THX 1138 kind of thing. It's just sort of like, I love the comments. Let me read you a couple of comments off the article on Petapixel. This is great. It says, the first comment is, mine just said blurry waste of time.
Yeah, that's the receipt. It's supposed to describe what the picture is. And it just says blurry waste of time.
And then this next guy says, yes, just what we need, more e-waste. 60 days after you bought your wastemic waste, the company goes under and you're left with a roll of thermo paper and some future toxic landfill material. And then this comment is great. What you need to do is feed the description into your text-to-image generator of choice and see what you get.
The whole thing is just, but at the same time, I love it because it's just so totally whack job. You know, I get the receipt is the part that makes it crazy.
Yeah, it's this is what I love, love, love about this is the twisted mind who came up with this.
Yeah.
Like literally like Neil Gaiman and Tim Burton are standing in the background like slow clapping this guy. Like, way to go, buddy. We wouldn't have even thought of that. That was just bizarre. So that's called the Memgram.
Created by a student because that's all you have. When you're a student, you got nothing better to do than sit in your dorm room, smoke a bowl and come up with the Memgram.
Yeah, bro.
Okay,
what if instead of pictures, a camera printed out just a piece of paper that tells you what you just took a picture of?
Oh, dude. Wait. And what if it looked like a horse? That's it.
What this if every big. Picture was a blunt, dude?
Call Starkiss.
Yeah, love it. Yeah, so way to go. And that's from Jamie Herman. Prints out it. Thanks, buddy. That's for... just bringing something weird into our lives this week. Yeah. That's fantastic.
I love the idea of it, though. All right, I'm ready to wrap up. You ready to wrap up?
Yeah, I got a quick question.
Okay.
This is an article on Petapixel, which read more like a Dear Abby. Is it ethical to edit a guest's pink hair out of your wedding photos? So this person got their photos from their photographer, wrote to this advice column and said, should I? There was somebody at my wedding who had bright pink hair. They're in the foreground, some pictures. Is it ethical to change their hair color so they're not distracting in the photos?
Okay.
What do you think?
What did the advice columnist say?
They said, here we go. My ethical preset would focus on the fact that the person with the pink hair surely didn't intend to photobomb the wedding and would probably be mortified by what you're seeing. Having pink hair doesn't mean that you think every situation you enter is about you. I completely disagree with that.
Yeah. The person would love the fact that they're photobombing all of your pictures. That's
literally
why they have
why
pink
they
hair.
Dyed their hair pink. Like,
they're not going to be mortified at all.
Worst opening paragraph to an advice
call. They'll be mortified if you take the pink hair out because now they're not important anymore.
What do you think somebody who dyes their hair bright pink? Do you think that they're like a real wallflower that doesn't want to be noticed?
Yeah.
I mean, there is literally 0% of people with bright pink hair that don't want people to notice it. That's like 0%. Yeah. So right off the bat, this person is very, very wrong. It says, any reasonable choice you make in editing the image that mitigates the problem is one you could defend to the guest. You wouldn't be disrespecting this person. You would be respecting your experience of the event. Basically I read the whole thing and they're like, yeah, sure. Why not? Which is what I would have said back. I'd just been like, yeah.
Like, you know, if they're in the foreground and that, I mean, if you're a photographer, there's anything in the foreground that's going to pull the eye, you're going to get rid of it one way or the other. So pink hair is no different than a bald
reduce
head.
Reduce the saturation, 30 or 40%, piece of cake. Like, like seriously, since your camera is just a bunch of whatever diodes interpreting the colors in the real world and 30% of people are freaking color deficient anyway, what freaking difference does it make? And you know what, if pink hair person wants to pick up a stink about it, you send them a link where they can buy a copy of the album with the pink hair in it. Otherwise, who cares? Do they have to look at it? Then no.
And they will be. Pink hair people will be upset, you know, that you changed my hair because their hair is so important to them and that's why it's pink. And they'll be totally incapable of understanding that it was not about you on that day, pink hair.
Well, make sure that when a pink haired person, when you have your wedding pictures, you make sure that the photographer uses a gray card and gets that pink just right. And then you'll be just fine. That's your great revenge on all of your friends is that you get really great pink hair in your wedding photos. Yeah, it's just anyway, I thought that was funny. I thought you'd have something to say about that. So, yeah, that's all I got.
Photobomb is written and produced by Bure Perry and Gary Hughes and edited by Face Fioretti. You can find us online. Go and join the Bombardiers Lounge at facebook.com/group/Bombardiers Lounge.
Bombardiers.
Our website is photobombpodcast.com. Gary's website is hughesfioretti.com.
So it is.
Mine is bureperry.com, and you can email us questions@photobombpodcast.com. We'll see you back here next week.
Destroy your enemies. Bring honor to the family name. Really, really, really like you.